This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Well, the schools may be closed today due to snow, but there are a lot of things going on with education, and we're going to spend this hour talking about what's happening in schools here in Mecklenburg and elsewhere around the state. Lisa Miller has been covering education for WFAE News since 2010, and she joins us for the hour. Welcome back. And Ann Doss-Helms has been covering the topic for the Charlotte Observer since 2002, and she, too, will be here for the hour. And we all made it in. How did we do it? I don't know. Welcome, all of you. You've been covering the schools the longest, and this schools used to be, I'm going to say it, a cauldron of controversy. What happened to all the controversy? Things have been relatively quiet in the scheme of things when you go back to, say, 2004, 2005.
Well, yes and no. What has happened, I think, is that the locus of decision-making changed pretty dramatically and rapidly, because for all these years that you and I have been talking, it's been all about Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools. And like you say, the drama, the decisions, the debates were all happening here in Charlotte with the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board. And whether it was student assignment or leadership changes or layoffs, it was here in Charlotte. And I think what's happened now is that the state has always played a role, but it was kind of a background role. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, the state is making these really sweeping and dramatic changes. And all of this is happening in Raleigh, and a lot of it happened this past summer during the budget bill. And now what you're seeing is the local schools having to react to that, whether it's this new reading program that's kicking up a lot of controversy, or whether it's the increase in school choice with vouchers and a surge in charter schools. The whole teacher compensation thing is huge. So there is still a lot of controversy. There's still a lot of angst about schools, but it's playing out in a way that's very challenging, I think, for all of us here in Charlotte, mm-hmm. whether we're reporters or whether we're interested citizens or advocacy groups. All of a sudden, we're trying to figure out the dynamics in Raleigh and how that affects us. Mm.
And one of the things that Raleigh has done is increase the number of charter schools beginning, this year and more to come next year. If I understand this, correct me if I'm wrong, they're going to bring 11 schools online in August.
Yeah,
here in Charlotte.
That's the plan, yep.
And 15 more opening elsewhere around the state. What has been the impact of the charter schools that have already been operating here and around the state?
You mean leading up to
yes.
When they lifted the cap?
Yes.
I mean, schools have planned for it. I mean, I think there's several thousand kids within Mecklenburg County and the Charlotte region going to charter schools. But what you see now, as you know, the cap was lifted a few years ago. There were 100 charter schools across the state. The idea that, you know, you cap them, they kind of monitor them. But that was lifted recently to have more choices, basically. And so now you see districts trying to scramble to keep up with how to plan when, you know, they're expecting maybe a couple thousand new kids going to charter schools next year, and then they're not sure how many the year afterwards.
But the decision to raise the cap, was that simply because somebody wanted more choice, or was it because the schools, the charter schools that have been open and have been operating, are having demonstrable success over and above the success at public schools?
Well, I think a lot of it is because people want more choice. And actually, you have these some charter authorizer organizations saying, hey, there shouldn't be a cap, because if you want quality charter schools, you want more competition. And, you know, how to sort of monitor which schools should exist and, you know, what schools shouldn't. There's a whole sort of different theories about that. But, you know, when you look sort of across the country and you look at charter schools, there was a study out of Stanford, I believe, a Credo study, that said, you know, it looks like about a third of charter schools do better than, you know, the local neighborhood schools. About a third perform about the same, and then a third are not as good. But the idea is that you close the ones that aren't as good, close, so that you have, you know, kind of the best operating.
And do they close in North Carolina because they're not good? I know they've closed because they've run out of money.
And they do sometimes close. And there is actually a law that says, based on test scores and growth rates, they can be forced to close after two consecutive years of really poor performance. And that's going to be really interesting to see that play out. With the old testing system, it wasn't that hard to meet the standards. And now with these new tests rolled out last year, and a majority of charter schools fell below the 60% proficiency level. That's one of the triggers. But an even larger majority of traditional public schools also fell below that. So, and I think that's what I've seen in the Charlotte schools, is that they tend to follow the same patterns that the traditional public schools do. It depends on the type of students they serve. When you look at test scores, you've got a charter school for highly gifted kids there at the top. You've got charter schools that serve the suburban kids who do well in any setting. They do very well. And you've got some charter schools that serve the disadvantaged kids. They perform much lower. I think there are at least a couple that are performing somewhat better than the public schools serving the same types of kids. But the question you raised, basically, what does this mean? That's a great question. I think that's a driving question for people who care about public education. And the real answer is, we don't know.
And when will we know?
It is going to be really challenging, because as opposed to following one big school board that does centralized reporting for 160 schools, each charter school is run by its own little board. And there is no news organization in this area, certainly not me and the Charlotte Observer, that is staffed to intensely cover each of these little individual areas. But that's a really crucial question. We need to know, how are they educating the kids and how are they spending the tax money?
Has there been any measurably negative impact, aside from the uncertainty, Lisa, that you spoke about with regarding how to plan at the public school level when you don't know how many kids are actually going to come to you versus the charter schools? Any measurably negative impact on the public schools?
Well, I mean, as far as public school districts would say, as far as dollars going to them, you know, that they are the dollars that would usually go to them for a student would go to the charter school who now has that student. So many districts.
Is it the same amount of money per student?
It's not. It depends on which district you are in, because you get the same because most districts have you get state money, and then you have a local supplement in the district.
And which comes from the public schools. I mean, the public schools are footing the bill for the charter schools, right?
You would say
that the state and the county and the federal government are footing the bill for traditional public schools and charter schools, which charter schools are public schools. They're a different type of public schools. Mm. But yes, CMS has to slice up, you know, if you look at the total Mecklenburg County population going to public schools and charters, there's about 10,000 kids in charter schools from Mecklenburg County. Some of those schools are actually in Mecklenburg County, some are in other counties. But each of those kids gets their slice of the county dollars and takes that with them to that charter school.
So I want to go back to the question I asked about, is it the same amount of money? If you are in Mecklenburg County and you could have gone to a public school, but you chose to go to a charter school in Mecklenburg County, is the money going to foot the bill for your student, your child in that charter school?
Yes.
The same amount of money that would go to that student in a public school, a CMS public school?
Yes, on average. It's a district-wide. Now, what some people would tell you is
that fair given the infrastructure of CMS? I mean, it's one of the biggest school systems in the country, and they've got all these people to pay salaries to and all these buildings to keep up with. Is it fair to give that same amount of money to a single self-governing charter school?
Well, the other thing is that charter schools don't get money for the building that they're in. So they say, you know, hey, we have to, you know, set up a building, get things started with a lot less than what a district would.
And then the CMS folks would counter, they don't have to provide lunches. They don't have to provide transportation.
Right.
So they can cut costs in that way. I think the question of whether charters are more or less cost efficient than a large school district is a fascinating one, and one that I want to try to figure out how to measure it, but it's going to be really complicated. Because you could also argue that each little charter school that has 100, 500, 1,000 kids has to recreate all of those things that CMS has. They still have to deal with special education and all the requirements that come with it. They may have to deal with the Title I program for high poverty schools. They have to understand all the laws. You know, they're not independent in the way a private school is. They still have to run a public school, and that's a very complicated matter.
And will there come a time when there are 10,000 students in charter schools in Mecklenburg County? How many students in the CMS system?
About 144.
Yeah. So it's about what?
About 93% in CMS versus 7 in charters right now.
Will we reach a tipping point at which the public schools will be underfunded for their needs because the money is going to students in charter schools?
No real way of knowing. You know, that's sort of a state policy question. And I think that is one of the burning questions at the state level, is how many charters do you keep adding? I hear from a lot of people who say, the cap was dumb. It was arbitrary. That, you know, that was not a good system. We needed to lift the cap. But we've gone, one national person I had just talked to said, you know, North Carolina went from zero to 100. That's going to stress any system. So if you keep adding at this level, something will give, whether it's charters that start to fail because they're competing with each other, whether it's, you know, CMS is still growing and growing at a pretty steady rate. But the question you raise, do you at some point look at CMS and go, wow, we are now down 5,000 students. We got to start closing some schools. That would certainly become a whole new policy issue.
What about the yardstick for measuring success or failure? Who does that for charter schools? Who decides whether you're successful or you're not? And how, is it the same yardstick that's being used to measure the public schools?
So there's an advisory group, a charter school advisory group, and it has some charter school educators. You know, it has advocates on the board. It has, you know, I think district principal, superintendent. And so they kind of make the calls, but there are specific things that they have to go by. For example, Anne mentioned before, if a charter school is for 2 years in a row, the kids are scoring, you know, I think it's
below 60%.
Yeah, below 60%.
And don't make growth. That's
yes.
kind of the key to that. But
that they can then close the school. The state can close the school. And that's a relatively recent development.
But are they going through the same testing? Do they have to have the same
yes.
curriculum?
Yes.
Do they have to have they're covering exactly the same things that the public schools are covering?
They don't need to have the same curriculum, but they're taking the same tests, so they better cover the same area.
Rebecca emails, with the increase of charter schools in North Carolina, has the support for these schools, primarily in the area of oversight, been increased as well? I understood that there isn't enough staff to provide appropriate oversight for the number of charter schools we have now, much less when we add more.
Well, I just spoke with somebody who's with the National Association that involves all the state's authorizing agencies, and he said North Carolina is understaffed. We have right now a director, an administrative assistant, and four people who go out and deal with the charter schools. There's another, the National Association has actually sent another person to North Carolina to help, and the state legislature has approved three more positions. But it's that's one of the things that's evolving, you know, because not only do they have to deal with roughly 70 applications a year, which is a huge workload, but a big part of it is, as we've talked about, monitoring the quality of the ones that are existing. And if you start adding, if you start with 100 and you add 25 a year, you are really increasing that workload, too.
Who are the kids going to at most of these charter schools? Are they lower-income kids whose parents are trying to find better options for their children? Are they middle-income kids whose parents want their children out of what they perceive to be bad public schools but who don't have the money for private schools? Who are they?
It's both.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so.
And do charter schools take everyone like the public schools, or can they be more selective?
To the same extent that magnets can be selective, there's a CMS magnet for highly gifted students or for gifted students. There's a charter for gifted students. But for the most part, a charter school has to say, here's what we are, here's where we are. If you apply, you either get in, or if there are too many applications, we hold a lottery. And it's sort of one of the interesting dynamics is this transportation and meals, because if you get in through the lottery, you cannot then be denied access because your parents can't feed you or you can't get a ride, but they can make it pretty clear that this will not be provided.
Ann Doss Helms covers education for the Charlotte Observer. Lisa Miller does so for us here at WFAE. We're going to come back and talk more about schools, not just charter schools, other aspects of schools as well in a minute. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bilo Supermarkets, serving the Southeast for over 50 years. Bilo offers bonus fuel perks items with the Bilo Bonus Card, store locator, weekly ad, and fuel perks program details at buy-low.com. Artificial intelligence. That's what I've got. It's the stuff of science fiction, and actually part of it is here. I mean, we can talk to Siri now. We can say, okay, Google now, and something happens on the other end of that transaction. Something sometimes relatively smart, sometimes really dumb. But we're working toward really creating computers and machines that are smarter than we are. What happens when we do? What are the moral implications of that? We'll look into that tomorrow at 9.
on the next Diane Rehm Show. In his fifth State of the Union address, President Obama raises income inequality, immigration reform, and health care. Analysis of the president's speech and what he can hope to achieve in an election year.
That's the Diane Rehm Show coming up from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about education with Lisa Miller from WFAE News and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer. Education has been their beat for about 127 years now. NPR did a story recently on a charter school in Nashville. This is Nashville, Tennessee, not Asheville. Nashville, Tennessee. That is experimenting with recruiting parents who can afford to send their children to private school under the theory that when you put rich kids in a school with poor children, that something good happens. And even the rich parents who have done this, who have taken the bait and put their kids into these charter schools as opposed to private schools, are happy that their children are being exposed to a different side of life. At least some of them are. And that's what good education, they say, is all about. These parents also say that this exposure can result in relationships being formed that span the divide between rich and poor. That sounds like a public school to me. And is this something that public schools should use as a marketing tool?
Well, and again, the charter folks would tell you charters are public schools. They're just a different type of public schools. Certainly there are CMS schools that have diversity and really value that, whether they're magnets or neighborhood schools. I think there are a lot of charters here that say we're trying to recruit a diverse population. Whether or not that happens, you know, that's always the big question, is it's hard to make that happen naturally. And if it doesn't, how much do you force it or encourage it?
I don't want to spend the rest of the hour on charter schools, but I do want to get to the bottom. Why are people putting their children in charter schools? Why are they taking them out of the traditional public schools and putting them in charter schools? What's their motivation?
I think they think they're getting a better education. And some of it, you know, maybe as well as there's more flexibility with charters. But I think it's, you know, they prefer this form of education.
You hear about crowded schools. You hear about low-performing schools. You hear about frustration that a CMS doesn't listen to me, doesn't pay attention. And for some, it really is that these schools just offer a different program in the same way that you might choose a magnet over your neighborhood school.
Laura on Facebook says our children's education is being stolen from them by high-stakes testing and mindless curriculum revisions. Public education belongs to the public, not for-profit charters, political extremists, and corporate interests. These groups have succeeded in weakening public education. As a parent and former educator, I am very sad. Now, this is what I'm trying to get to because, Ann, you quoted in one of your articles, Kevin McLean, who's the president of North Carolinians for Home Education, as comparing the traditional public school system to train travel, which he described as a 200-year-old technology that did great things for America, but most of us don't take trains today. And then he referred to the options that we have, like air travel. But isn't that a false comparison? I mean, if we had updated the train system in America the way they did in Europe, we'd be taking the trains today.
Yeah.
So if we update the public school system, wouldn't that be a great option? Have the public schools failed us after 100 years because they just are outdated technology or because we don't believe in them anymore and we have another way to do it that will enrich our friends?
Well, and I think a lot of people would say CMS is a system that's been adapting. Mm-hmm. It's not a Detroit where there's nobody left. It's got a lot of options. It's got still a strong level of participation. But yes, and the testing part, that is an interesting component of that because I do think there is a strong sentiment. Now, charters are not going to be your way to escape testing, but that a completely understandable desire for accountability has turned into a fixation with giving kids lots and lots and lots of tests, whether it's to decide whether they can move up to fourth grade, mm-hmm. or whether it's really a big driving factor behind this is we're going to give little Johnny a test because we want to know if little Johnny's teacher is any good. And we're going to take all these test scores and we're going to run them through this complicated formula. And we're going to get a number that says this teacher's great, this teacher's okay, and this teacher needs to be steered to another career. And there's a lot of frustration with that, I think.
CMS is responding to the increased competition of these charter schools with new options of their own. And they say they are not a reaction to charter schools, but a wise thing to do. Do you believe that, Lisa?
Well, I think it's probably that they feel like they do have to offer more options, but I imagine they are certainly feeling pressure. And I thought it was really interesting. Anne had an article about, you can talk about this better, but you know, it's interesting to look at how districts are working with charters. And when Heath Morrison came in here, he said, hey, you know, I think we need to collaborate more. I think we need to get all the charter folks in a room together with us district folks and talk about ways that we can kind of help each other.
Yeah, the public schools, the CMS schools have increased options, like college-based high schools and new magnet schools in response to this, or they say it's not in response to this.
No, actually, I think Heath Morrison does say this is a factor in our life now.
Okay.
We need to make this a good, viable option.
So by providing these options, are they not playing right into the hands of the people who favor charter schools, who say we need to have more options? And because options provide competition, competition is good. That means this is working, right?
Well, and Heath Morrison says charters can be good. Options are good. You know, good charters are good. And I think that's the big – there are people who believe philosophically either that charters are inherently better than traditional public schools, and there are people who believe the opposite, that they're detrimental. But for most people, it's figuring out – good charter schools are good for kids. Bad charter schools are a waste of public money and even worse, a waste of those children's educational time. How do we know that we're encouraging the good ones?
I want to move away from charter schools, but before we do, I want to get some answers to some questions that have been coming in over the transom here. Chris emails, is it true that charter school teachers don't need to meet the same requirements as teachers in traditional public schools? Is that true or not?
Yes. Mm-hmm. They only have to have 50% of their teachers certified. So when you hear that there's a very low teacher-student ratio, some of those teachers may be people who would not be able to be qualified as teachers.
So if we are so concerned about testing little Johnny so that we can figure out whether his teacher is any good or not and whether that teacher should be rewarded or just kept in place or shifted off to assembling widgets someplace, why are we not concerned about that in the charter schools?
Well, one of the big questions, I think there is a sense that the structure we've had for training and evaluating teachers is not perfect, and some would say really broken. So I think the idea with charters is that maybe that traditional system of education and credentialing is not going to get us the best people. If they bring in people who don't have that credential and their kids do really great, then maybe we've got some interesting information to work with.
Well, I think, Lisa, you said that when I asked who's going to these charter schools, you said everybody, the same makeup of the public schools that's going to these charter schools. But Kedrick emails, what happened if your family can't provide transportation or lunch? Doesn't that make for a de facto richer charter school for kids?
Well, yeah, I mean, that is a big obstacle out there. But, you know, you do have many charter schools that, for example, Sugar Creek Charter, they serve a lot of low-income kids, and they say, this is part of our mission. We are going to offer transportation. We're going to offer lunch. But, I mean, yes, that is an obstacle for many charter schools as
well.
And
I would point out that some of the magnets in CMS now, you have to get your child to a shuttle stop. They no longer do, for some magnets, they do door-to-door busing, but not for all of them. Some magnets have admission requirements. So you have some CMS magnet schools that have not necessarily a richer but a more advantaged, a more successful student body.
Yeah.
And that leaves then the neighborhood schools with the folks who can't get in.
So Joan wants to know, do you know how many charter schools were opened by religious groups?
You cannot get a religious charter. Now, the church may be a founding entity, but the charter has to be secular.
Okay.
And they actually, if it is housed in a church, they have to cover up any religious iconography, you know, cover the cross. Yeah. You know, they can't be praying and teaching the Bible.
Let's move on to something else here. You say that the state will start taking opportunity scholarship applications in February. These are what, vouchers for low-income kids to attend private schools? Is that what they are?
Yes, up to $4,800 a year, which, as many people will note, does not cover tuition for a whole lot of private schools here in Charlotte.
So how many of these will be available, these scholarships?
My understanding is that they set aside a dollar amount, and I don't know that I've seen that translated to a number of students. I guess it will depend on how many apply, and I don't know if they get,
And where is this money coming from? We can't fund the public schools. We can't give teachers raises, but we can do $4,800 vouchers?
Yeah, and it's about $10 million, I believe, that's been set aside for this. It comes from the state. They decided to spend that.
And if the vouchers don't cover the cost of private education, how much does it fall under the threshold of a private education? $4,800 versus how much does it actually cost to go to Charlotte Country Day or
$20,000 plus.
Yeah, and it depends what private school. I mean, there's a range, but it's at least a few thousand short, I would say, of
so
many.
So why bother with the
schools.
Vouchers? If it's not going to pay the freight, why bother?
Well, for instance, I talked with the headmaster of Trinity Episcopal School, which is a school that says it highly values diversity. They already have a financial aid program. And what he said is that $4,800 might help a parent get there between what we can offer and what they can pay. That, you know, I don't think this is going to be thousands of kids in Mecklenburg County. I think this is going to be a relatively small number, although I could be wrong. And it is going to, and again, I think what it does is if you're the private school, you don't have to take a kid with a voucher. So again, if you're that extremely gifted child from a low-income family, this may be really helpful in getting you into a private school. Mm-hmm. There's also a fear that there's going to be kind of, you know, Jim Bob's voucher schools are going to start popping up where, you know, we're going to give you what we can get on $4,800 a year. And whether that happens or not is something else.
If you were a private school, why wouldn't you take the voucher student? As long as they can pay the rest of it up front in cash, why wouldn't you take the voucher student? Because they're not academically ready to do it? What would be your reason for not taking them?
Yeah, private schools all have their selection standards, whether that's academics, whether that's, you know, whatever.
So could this be considered a subsidy, a state-funded, taxpayer-funded subsidy for private schools?
I mean,
will this increase enrollment?
I don't know if it's going to increase enrollment by that much. I mean, the program is going to expand, but I mean, yes, I mean, it is taxpayer money.
Yeah, most of the successful private schools have waiting lists. So it's not like, you know, we have these three empty classrooms. Whew, thank goodness the vouchers will let us fill them. It's going to be, again, just kind of jockeying within that pool of who gets admitted and then who gets that.
So will this have any kind of impact, or is this just a feel-good thing from the legislature for one political point of view to say we're doing something? I mean, is it really going to mean anything to people? Will there be enough seats?
That remains to be seen. You know, I think we'll want to be following up on who goes and – you know, I hope that somebody is doing some kind of study on whether these kids actually do better in their private schools and whether they stay. That's the other thing. You know, do you get in and you spend a year at whatever, and then for whatever reason that voucher goes away or the help goes away and you're back at CMS or wherever?
A huge issue for a very long time has been and continues to be teacher pay. North Carolina teachers fall on the low end of the pay scale nationally. What does that say to businesses who may or may not want to locate here to the state? What does it say to qualified teachers or to young graduates from education schools who want to teach and have an impact and they look at places they want to live and this is one of them until they find out what it pays?
Yeah, I mean, kind of measuring that impact because about, was it 10 years ago or so, we were at kind of the state average as far as, I'm sorry, the country's average as far as teacher salary. But this kind of average number of teacher salary is sort of a big rallying point as far as politically. It's held up a lot. Some people say, hey, what you got to do is really look at the starting salary for teachers here in North Carolina as far as it making an impact and, you know, how quickly you can go up the pay schedule. And, you know, what not only is our teacher pay salary pretty low compared to some other states, the average, but, you know, we have been basically for the past 5 years, teachers haven't gotten much of a raise because pay has kind of been frozen. So that has its own effect too, and kind of bringing all the teachers kind of up to that regular where they should be on the salary schedule would cost a whole bunch.
From the point of view of somebody like me who doesn't cover this every day and doesn't have these constant conversations with teachers and administrators and parents and students, this looks rather perverse. I mean, on the one hand, we are testing students almost on a daily, hourly basis, to see how the teacher is performing. We're very concerned about teacher performance and weeding out the bad teachers. And yet money talks, and everybody in any capitalistic endeavor knows that usually the higher end of the pay scale is going to attract the better people. yet we're at the bottom of the heap in teacher pay. Do we really want good teachers in the public schools? I mean, well, if so, why aren't we paying for them?
And I think state lawmakers would say, hey, you know, what you do see is, you know, these performance bonuses basically coming up. They say, yeah, we do think good teachers should be paid more. The bonuses don't – they amount to about $5,000 over 4 years.
But you have to relinquish.
And you have to relinquish your tenure, which is a
where we are,
big thing.
You know, think about if you're remodeling your house and your kitchen or your bathroom or whatever gets so outdated that you say, I've got to do something. And there's going to be a stage where it's torn up and horrible. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of where we are right now. I think most people would say that North Carolina's teacher pay system is bad, needs to be remodeled. Mm-hmm. Whether it's simply the overall amount available, but even the way that the pay happens, that so much of it is based on just sticking in there versus rewards for performance.
Well, they are dismantling it.
And that's the interesting thing is the state legislature has started dismantling it in a pretty dramatic way. And what they would say is, but you know, eventually you're going to have that brand new kitchen and you're going to be really happy that you went through this hardship. And what the critics would say is you dismantled it without having a plan or a budget to actually put a new one in.
Right.
And there's some truth to that. We don't have a plan right now for a good, solid statewide plan, let alone the money to execute it for a better system.
Governor McCrory has said he wants to raise pay for teachers next year. Has he said by how much? And is this something that he can actually do, or does it require the legislature to do it?
I haven't heard him say anything about how much at this point. He said, repeatedly that he wants to raise it. So.
And I think what you'll see in May when they reconvene is sort of like what we saw a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. There will be a small raise. And it might make people less unhappy, but nobody's going to be, you know, dancing in the streets if you get 1, 2, 3%.
There's a legislative task force, right? Education
there is.
Task force?
They just
getting
and
organized.
Oddly, the Senate waited several months to actually appoint its members, so now they've got an April 15th deadline to report, and I don't think they've actually set a first meeting.
Are these the people who will be helping to make these teacher pay decisions and other decisions regarding education?
You know, it seems to change so rapidly. CMS is on its fourth task force studying teacher compensation.
Yeah. Under McCrory's plan, I think it's McCrory's plan, 25% of teachers will get a raise, but there is that catch. You have to give up, you have to voluntarily relinquish their tenure. How likely are teachers to do that? Take the $5,000 now versus maybe losing your job next year because you don't have tenure anymore.
Well, and tenure, it looks like it's going to be going away in a few years. So I don't know. I don't have a good feel for how many teachers will feel like an extra $500 next year will be worth giving that up.
And how will the 25%, because only 25% are getting this choice, this Sophie's choice, how will they choose these people?
That's what a lot of districts are trying to figure out. CMS just surveyed teachers to see how they would like to have that 25% picked. I don't know the results of that survey, but yeah, this is all what districts are trying to get their heads around that. But some of it will have to do with growth on test scores, I'm sure.
Lisa,
I don't think anybody would say that that's the system. That's sort of an interim stopgap.
Yeah.
Lisa Miller and Ann Doss Helms cover education for WFAE, and in Ann's case, the Charlotte Observer. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the UNC Center for Aortic Disease, providing comprehensive treatments for all aortic diseases. Information at uncaortic.org. In his fifth State of the Union address, President Obama raises income inequality, immigration reform, and health care as issues. Diane Rehm and her guests provide analysis of the president's speech and what he can hope to achieve in an election year. 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation about schools, about education, about what's going on around the state in Mecklenburg County, in Union County, and elsewhere, go to the computer. Find us at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks and jump into all of this. And we're coming right back.
From the moment you wake up.
Good morning. More than a third of the judgeships on a major U.S. circuit court are vacant.
Through your drive home.
Make no mistake, we will get to the bottom of this.
Listen all day, every day. NPR News, always on.
NPR News, along with WFAE local and regional news updates, all day on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about education today here and around the state with Ann Doss Helms from The Observer and Lisa Miller from WFAE News. CMS has convened its fourth consecutive teacher compensation task force. Have they made any recommendations?
At last I heard from them was maybe last year.
The new one I have not heard any recommendations from. The old one was kind of focused on, you may be hearing about this opportunity culture as one of the options out there, where a school within its existing budget eliminates or scales back some positions in order to create a real number of really highly paid teaching jobs. If you're that great teacher in the school, you're suddenly responsible for maybe four classes, working with those teachers to improve their skills, working directly with the students. It's supposed to be a way that a teacher can get a real raise, you know, not a 1% or 2% raise, but up to $23,000 in some cases a year by taking on additional responsibilities but not having to leave the classroom to become a principal or an administrator.
One of the things, we had State Treasurer Janet Cowell on this program about a week or two ago, and she mentioned that state employees, and teachers are state employees, are not eligible for retirement, for the retirement package, until they've been on an employee for 10 years. I mean, how many teachers – from the day they walk in the door the first day, make it to 10 years?
I don't know.
So not only are we not paying them very well to start, if they leave at 9.5 years, they have no retirement.
You've got me. That's an issue that I'm not – we certainly do lose a significant number of teachers in the first 5 years, but – the retirement, I don't know that I've ever heard that as a big driving factor in that.
Okay. Let's move over to Union County for a second, because they are experiencing growing pains in Union County. For years now, they've been touted for the quality of their schools, particularly versus Mecklenburg County. That's been used as a marketing tool both for the county and for home builders. That, in addition to lower housing prices, have caused a flood of people to move to Union County. And now Union County schools, particularly in, I think, southwestern Union County, are overcrowded. And I spoke with one Union County parent just last week who moved there and who was apoplectic, and rightfully so, that his kids might be moved out of a high-performing school right down the street because their house is on this line that they're talking about changing the districts for. So his kids would have to be shifted to a lower-performing school, and he just moved there to be in that school. Talk about what Union County is facing and where they are in their redistricting process at the moment.
Well, Union County, as we were talking about before, is kind of where Mecklenburg County in some regards was maybe, you know, 10 years ago. I mean, it is growing really fast there. And you have a lot of people in western Union County who go there for the schools. It's, you know, they may work uptown Charlotte and they just hop on and go across the line and, you know, commute into work. So you have this really high growth area on the western side of the county. And over the past few years, there has been quite a bit of redistricting, and especially in some of these subdivisions that are seeing a lot of growth. So now what the proposal is, the district says, hey, you know, we've kind of been doing these stopgap measures. We've opened – this is kind of hard to imagine, but in the last, I think, since 2000 or so, they've doubled the amount of schools in Union County. So it's gone from 23 to 53. And so there has to be a lot of redistricting when you open new schools. But now they don't, you know, really have the money to build new schools. And the district says, hey, if we built new schools, there's kind of this bubble going through a high, you know, a lot of kids in a couple grades, but after that passes, it kind of goes down. They say we'll have some empty schools, you know, in a matter of a few years. So they're saying this redistricting is, you know, we've had stopgap measures. This is a broad redistricting. It would take about 6,000 students and spread them out to schools. And parents are really upset. I mean, they've gone through redistricting before, and they say, you're not going to move my kid again. And especially when you have, you know, there's some cases where the kid is going to the school 2 miles away, and the redistricting would change them to several miles away. But there is the whole dynamic of Yes, going from a higher performing school to a lower performing school, having longer.
Why would there be higher and? Explain this to me. Why are there higher and lower performing schools? Is it the makeup of the school population? Is that what it is?
Yeah, and
but wouldn't if you're going to move, if you're going to expand, if they're growing. So if they're overcrowded and they need to move kids to a lower performing school, they're going to move kids who are in a high performing school, who are presumably high performing students, into that lower performing school. Wouldn't that raise, and they'll move teachers too, wouldn't that raise the performance level of that lower performing school?
I mean, it very possibly could, you know, but parents are worried. They, you know, they say, hey, our kid shouldn't be, you know, we have a great school here. It's in our neighborhood, and they're doing well here, and we're worried if they go to the lower performing school that they won't do as well there.
You've reported that in a handful of overcrowded Union County schools, there are fears that they could no longer safely serve kids lunch or accommodate them during tornado drills. Why is lunch safety a concern in an overcrowded school?
Well, I mean, it's also an issue of where your lunch schedule is. So there are kids eating lunch at 10:45 in the morning, for example. So they're saying, hey, we don't have enough cafeteria space. We don't have enough room for tornado drills. And, you know, parents are saying, hey, our schools were a lot more crowded a few years ago. And, you know, this wasn't brought up. But, you know, now the district says, well, this is a concern. We have seats in other parts of the county, so, you know, we should get on this.
One possible alternative to this, I'm told, is setting up some schools as year-round schools on a staggered calendar, so you'd have different student populations attending the same school at different times of the year. Where that has been discussed in the past, if I'm not mistaken, and that's been Mecklenburg County, among other places, it tends to meet with opposition because we all are married to this agrarian school calendar that was set up for a different time for different reasons. Is there any opposition or significant opposition to something like this happening in lieu of redistricting in Union County?
Well, the plans I hear mostly from parents don't involve going to year-round school. It basically sort of involves maybe, you know, adding mobiles or kind of repositioning the school a little bit, classrooms and things like that. So, I mean, I haven't heard a lot of opposition to year-round schools, but I also haven't heard a lot of parents saying, yeah, this is a great idea. Let's get on this bandwagon.
Put your headphones on, and we'll take a call here from Aaron, who's calling us from Stallings. Aaron, welcome. Oh, let me turn you on. Sorry, Aaron. Go ahead.
I have a son that's at Stallings Elementary School, and his twin sisters will be coming in the fall of 2015. I'm concerned to relate this back to charter schools. There is the possibility of 5 charter schools opening in the fall of 2015. 3 in Union County, 2 in Mecklenburg, all of them expecting to draw students from Union County. And I think the final approval for those will be in June, but that is not being taken into consideration when the board is looking at their numbers.
Yeah.
This has not been factored in at all.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, I was going to say that's true. And, you know, the school district says, hey, well, we don't know for sure that those schools are going open. But, yeah, there's a lot that are planning to open.
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly. So why the rush then? Why the rush to have this vote in April? If we're going to know in June if these 5 schools are approved to open 2015, why are we trying to push this through so fast? Another concern that I have is that it seems like in many instances, the same children, the same families, the same neighborhoods are being redistricted over and over again. I have neighbors. I live in the Willowbrook subdivision. We also are close to Humley Creek. I know some parents, this be the second and third redistricting for their children. Now, if you look at the numbers, after the redistricting, you've got 4 high schools that are still on what they call watch levels, 2 middle schools, and 2 elementary schools. You're shifting kids around, and what's going to happen in 3 to 5 years? Redistricting again. It's a stopgap measure just as much as anything else is, and it's kicking the can down the road continually.
Erin, thank you for your call. Have you heard this from other parents and about the same households being targeted for redistricting repeatedly?
And again, this all sounds very familiar. That was an issue and has been an issue in Mecklenburg County as well.
And why the rush? I mean, if she's right about this April vote versus a discovery of how many kids are going to charter schools in June, why not wait till July or the end of June?
Charters really complicate planning for the school districts because even if you know you've got X number of charters and you can look at their applications and say they expect to take this number of students from Union and this number of students from Mecklenburg, you don't know that that's actually what's going to happen. Some charters, in fact, a lot of new charters open under enrollment, and the kids may come from different places. County lines are not an issue for charters. And regardless of whatever they do this year, then there will be a whole new round coming down the pike.
This program has focused in the last 15 years a lot on Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools during all the controversies that we've done. And so has the Charlotte Observer.
Yes.
Does Union County get the same kind of attention? Does Gaston County, not from us, I'm asking at the Observer, does Gaston County get the same kind of attention? And would they benefit from that attention, or do we just cause the heat to get higher with no results? We, the media.
Well, you know, it's funny because I actually live in Gaston County, and I have heard from some people in the Gaston County school system, they're sort of relieved that they don't have the level of scrutiny that CMS gets. But I've also heard from Gaston County parents saying, and we do have, you know, the Gaston Gazette covers schools there,
right.
And I'm not at all equipped to evaluate all the community coverage in the surrounding areas, but I do believe, from my obviously biased perspective, that good journalistic coverage, intense knowledge of a system, intense reporting of that is a benefit to the community.
Common Core standards are beginning to feel some heat. Pamela emails that most parents and teachers in North Carolina would say that high-stakes standardized testing is out of control. There's no evidence that this level of testing has improved public education, and plenty of evidence about the damage it has done in terms of narrowing curricula, promoting teaching to the test, driving good teachers out of the profession. Yet elected officials keep mandating more tests, as in Race to the Top, and raising the stakes, as with North Carolina's requirement that third graders pass reading tests to move on to fourth grade. How can frustrated parents and teachers reach these elected officials with the message that this strategy is doing far more harm than good?
Well, you hear districts already, you know, CMS has said, is when it comes to the reading in particular, that said, hey, you know, this is too many tests as far as figuring out, you know, teacher, you know, how these kids are doing. And there was a state lawmakers did hear from people yesterday about, you know, hey, we can't, you know, isn't making sense for our district. And they're saying, hey, we didn't realize it would kind of roll out this way. But yes, I mean, you do start hearing districts and parents really speaking out about this and trying to get to state lawmakers and have things changed.
We talked more fully about this in an earlier program, but this new reading law that will test third graders, and if they can't read at third grade level, they are not going to fourth grade. They're going to have to go to summer reading camps in order to get into the fourth grade. That's a summary of it. Are parents and kids ready for that possibility? Because we're talking about possibly, what, a lot of kids.
There's a lot of kids.
Yes.
And, you know, basically, it's that they would go, you know, if you
5,000 kids, I think, is the number I read.
And CMS.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you look at test scores from last year, it would be about 50% of all third graders across the state.
And this is an unfunded mandate on the public schools. The state legislature said you have to.
Not totally unfunded. Yeah. There is some money for summer camps.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. Yeah, there is money for summer camps.
Okay.
They've been having to test, you know. Let me start over again. It's not, when I first heard about this, I thought it was you don't pass the test. You're going to be held back in third grade. You might have to go to the summer camp. And then if you don't pass again, you'll be held back. But basically what happens is the kid goes on to fourth grade, but has what's called a retention label, which isn't that they have to wear a dunce hat in the corner, but they have more sort of concentrated reading instruction. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, this is, it's looking like a huge amount of kids may be going to these summer camps in the, starting in June.
My understanding is that the schools have to create special types of classes. It's not just mm-hmm. a label on the kids' file. It's that you have to take some of your highest performing reading teachers and create either combined third, fourth grade classes or intensive reading classes. And another twist, this is kind of in the devil in the details, if your child gets identified for summer camp and the note comes home or whatever and, you know, your son needs to go here and you say, for whatever reason, I can't do that, bam, your child stays in third grade. He does not get one of these transitional classes. Yep. He's retained. And the state mandate as it stands now, I suspect they'll change it, is that these camps be for 3 hours a day for 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. Well, if you're a working parent, a three-hour-a-day camp is not exactly a godsend. You know, you then have to find a way to get them into something else for the other half a day. So I think parents are just starting to find out if their kids are at risk, and I think there will be a lot of concern. Excuse me.
A digital learning becoming a reality. I've less than a minute here. You say that this is really hard for the layperson to grasp how this technology is being used and how it's likely to be used in the future. What do you mean we don't grasp it?
Well, I think what people tend to get is my kid has an iPad. And if that's all it is, and you hear a lot of fears that my kid is playing games on his iPad, there are really good creative ways that you can use online learning, but it's new to most of us, so we're kind of trying to figure it out. Teachers are trying to figure it out. Schools are. The kids may understand it better than anybody.
Better than the teachers. Yeah. Is it going to end up being more than just a toy in the classroom? I mean, we've survived for thousands of years on paper. Do we really need an iPad to make education better? Seriously. And I'm a proponent of computers. Do we really need them?
Well, I think about how much I use digital networks, digital research, digital, you know, I'm not writing my stories on pencil and paper anymore, and I wouldn't want to. I think it's moving that way.
It's preparation for the future. Ann Doss Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, Lisa Miller, education reporter for WFAE News. Thank you both.